Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Guys, we've reached a milestone. This is the 100th episode of Science Mixtape. And in honor of that, we're going to have a look back at all the wonderful guests we've had over the years and pick some of our favourite moments. I actually first came on the show as a guest. I was talking about light and what I do research-wise at Imperial. And obviously, I loved the setup here and managed to stay on and find out so much about different areas of science. And so let's have a listen into my very first foray into the world of Science Mixtape.
Yeah, so light's everywhere. And the amazing thing is that we see such a tiny amount of the light that's actually out there. So,
yeah,
you know, we even use other bits of light to do things like x-rays. X-rays are light, and radio waves are all
light. Part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Exactly.
I guess what we think of light is only what we call visible light, but you're right, they're all the same breed, species, however you want to define it.
Family. It's all photons.
So what is a photon?
So this is, a photon is this idea that when we normally think about light, we think about light as being a wave in space, and it's kind of electricity and magnetism shaking, and so it transmits through space by these shaking waves.
Yeah, because a wave is just a way of transferring energy.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like the ripples on the surface of a pond. You can drop a stone and you see the waves kind of spread out. They dissipate the energy from the stone dropping in. And the problem is with that kind of wave description is that when you look at individual atoms, the way they interact with light is not really wavy. It's kind of different. And that's because when an atom absorbs light, it goes from one state to another state very quickly. And so the stuff that's absorbed is kind of not a long wave, which happens over a long period of time, but a short packet. And that short packet we call a photon. And so by describing light as these kind of short packets that go around and are absorbed and emitted by different things, we get a better understanding of the way light actually is.
Okay, so you could think of like a particle of light rather than a wave of light.
Yes, but it's not really a particle. This is where it kind of gets, people say, a bit strange, but it's...
Physics has always got to get a bit strange, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So you have something that's kind of a particle and kind of a wave. It behaves like a wave sometimes and like a particle sometimes. And when you get into this regime, things are really described by quantum mechanics. So that's when people are talking about this wave-particle duality in quantum mechanics. It's because sometimes it's best to describe it like a wave, and sometimes it's best to describe it like a particle.
When I first learned about wave-particle duality, it was literally like such a mind-blowing thing. You learn at school, light is a wave. You learn that, and you just think, okay, I've got it. I know how it works. I can see that, you know, diffracts around doors, and it reflects, and it bends through different things like glass. But when you learn that it's also a particle, you just can't comprehend that, because waves that you see in water are not also particles, or waves that you hear as sound are not also particles. And yeah, just the fact that, you know, people were able to kind of really, that's really thinking outside the box, that they could get the, it was a famous experiment called the double slit experiment, that they could get those results and be like, well, waves just don't explain these results. Yeah. Must be a particle. Like, I just think that's one of the most exciting things about physics, is how the people who are sort of really at the edge of physics are just so creative in the way that they look at the world and describe it.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is, we thought about light as being a wave, and then we figured out that it's actually a particle. And the same thing happened with electrons, but the other way around. So we always thought that they were particles, a particle, but actually they have this kind of wavy nature too. So it goes through all of physics, this wave-particle duality.
Oh my, I sounded so young. No, I sounded exactly the same. That was just me and Matilda really getting into Science Mixtape for the first time. So we're going to finish off with one of my favourite songs, just to complete the self-indulgence. that was Earth, Wind and Fire with September. This show goes out as a podcast too, and this next guest is our most popular, well, in terms of downloads anyway. Robin Carhart-Harris is a researcher who looks into the effects of psychedelic drugs. You know, a little bit out there, maybe that's why it's so popular. It does already sound quite out there, but his areas of research drift even into something equally as esoteric. We had a great show talking about things as deep as the ego and the nature of the self. So here's a snippet of Robin getting heavy.
This would be a way to sort of reveal the unconscious mind.
Yeah, inspired by people writing about that. And really the angle that I wanted to go at this with was one of neuroscience. I wanted to understand the biology of these ideas, psychoanalytic ideas. You know, where's the ego in the brain? Where's the unconscious mind? What is it? What is repression? You know, and I, you know, still believe and think we've made some inroads with respect to identifying these things.
What did you find?
Oh, well, if we focus on the ego, mm-hmm. we've based on other literature, but also based on our work with psychedelic drugs, psilocybin, magic mushrooms, and also LSD, we've identified a particular network in the brain, which is arguably the strongest candidate for a neural substrate, if you want, of the sense of self or ego. And we found that this network, known as the default mode network, appears to dissolve or disintegrate under the effects of psychedelics. And this effect correlates with people's reports of ego dissolution.
And is that, when you say reports of ego dissolution, is that the feeling that you're connected to everything?
Yes, it's very much related. In fact, the two things are synonymous, really. When the ego dissolves, what accompanies that is a feeling of oneness, you know, that kind of thing that you would attribute to sort of hippie speak, you know, we're all one, you know.
There really does seem to be like a kind of neuro element of that. That's really cool.
Yeah, we've got, you know, some hypotheses about that. Mm. I guess it's too early to say it's established, I think we've got some important leads on that.
And in your brain scans, I think I've seen you say that you found the brain was kind of hyper-connected.
Yeah.
When someone was kind of taking LSD and tripping.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that, what you think that kind of means?
Yeah, well, we're just learning, but that's one of the effects that seems to correlate with ego dissolution. So you could describe it as a global connectivity in the brain. So you have modules or systems in the brain that are normally quite separate from each other, quite segregated from each other. And they kind of need to be because they subserve different functions. And so they have, they give us and they give the brain and the mind some specialization so that it can do...
Like the visual part or the language part. Or...
Exactly. But what you see under psychedelics is that these different modules now start talking to each other much more. And if you look at the big picture, the whole of the brain, it's much more interconnected. It's communicating much more freely. And this effect did correlate with ego dissolution. And as a sort of working hypothesis, we're putting forward the idea that it may relate to this sense of oneness. The globally connected brain is related to a feeling of being globally connected, if you want.
Wow. And is that similar to how the brain looks when you're dreaming? Because people describe the kind of psychedelic hallucinations as dreamlike.
There might be other circuits that are more relevant in that context, actually, in terms of the visual aspect of dreaming and the visual aspect of psychedelics. But what it is related to is the early brain, so early in development. So if we think about an infant's brain and we think about the psychology of being an infant and not really knowing that you exist, that you're separate from other people. And so, you know, there's quite a clear link there, I think.
So that's so cool. So an infant's brain, I guess it hasn't really become specialised yet, has it?
No.
And you're seeing the brain revert to that kind of state.
Yeah, it kind of regresses back to that infantile state. And, you know, people have talked in a poetic way, Wordsworth and such like, about infants being in a sort of spiritual state, closer to God. I think maybe Jesus might have said something about about children being closer to God. You know, but then babies aren't that sophisticated in other senses. So, you know, this is one of the things about the brain and the mind, is there are trade-offs here and there, you know.
What's your second song?
Oh, yeah, so I think we're going with Left Field, Storm 3000, from their classic album.
So that was a Robin Carhart Harris from an episode entitled Your Brain on LSD. Robin ended up selecting some cracking tunes, including this one by New Order. This is Ceremony. Order with Ceremony. One of my favourite guests that has been to have on has been Jeff Stryker. Jeff works at the Natural History Museum in London, and I really enjoyed the whole process of getting on the show. I actually didn't know that so much research was done at the Natural History Museum, and I went along to go and meet Jeff before he came on the show. And it was fascinating to find out how it feeds into scientific research, as well as, you know, presenting things to the public and having them on show, like everybody knows. So rather than me telling you about what Jeff does, here's Jeff describing what he does in his own words.
Yeah, so herpetology, like you mentioned in the beginning of the recording, it includes amphibians and reptiles, but only certain reptiles. So it's kind of an interesting group, that what's classically thought of as herpetology. So it's a specialized focus on certain animals, but a lot of the reptiles we look at aren't, you know, they have some living relatives, the birds, that right. I don't study, but probably I should from an evolutionary perspective. So herpetology as a discipline kind of has some historical hangovers from when amphibians and reptiles, non-bird reptiles like snakes, lizards, crocodiles, and turtles were thought to be crawling things, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show. One of the reasons it's kind of stuck, why we still do that, even though we study everything from an evolutionary perspective now, is because a lot of the methods we use to find these animals in the field, to study them in the laboratory, and to work with their genes, like we'll talk about in a little bit, are very similar when you apply them to snakes, lizards, frogs, salamanders, and animals like that.
So the grouping itself is kind of a hangover from historically what was all studied together.
Right, yeah.
And now we have a better understanding of what's related to what. We might actually divide up slightly differently.
Sure, absolutely. And it's given us great new insights in terms of why the anatomy of reptiles has evolved the way that it has versus amphibians and things like that, for sure. And in terms of what I do at the museum, so I'm in charge of the herpetology collection. And so along with my colleagues there, we take care of about 200,000 specimens. We spend time also hosting visiting researchers from all over the globe that come to collect data from our collection. And also we do a bit of training as well with a lot of local universities here in London.
Okay, so people come to the university and they do research there, and you kind of host them, and they're able to use the specimens and use the research that you do at the university.
Absolutely. Most of the students work out of the museum. So even though their degree comes from the university, they spend most of their time behind the scenes at the museum learning about the specimens that we have there.
Yeah, because like most people go to the museum and they see the specimens on display. They don't really see, actually, there's quite a lot going on in the background.
Absolutely. There's an entire world behind the scenes at the Natural History Museum that's on a daily basis being used to teach us about what's happened in the past and also allowing us to predict what might happen in the future.
Brilliant. So your background is actually in molecular biology.
That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, what is that? What were you studying, and how does it apply
to the work you're doing now?
Yeah, so my training is as something called a molecular systematist. And what that means is that we take DNA from different organisms, in my case, primarily amphibians and reptiles. We sequence a couple of, we sequence their DNA, which when I was training was normally a gene or two genes. And then we compare those same genes and we use that to kind of help us try and figure out how they might be related to one another, how long it's been since they shared a common ancestor. So that's how my training started. But as I'm sure you've had other guests on this show that have talked about just how the age of genomics is upon us, and now we use DNA in so many ways that we never could have imagined we'd use it before. And so whereas before we were kind of using it to tell us how is species A related to species B, now we're using the same techniques that I learned to look at whole genomes and think about how genomes evolve through time, and also using it to tell it to help us test hypotheses about how physiology works in different animal groups. So we actually can take the RNA molecules that that ultimately become proteins, and we can look at their content in different tissues now. That's how my training kind of relates to how I apply my training to what I do now, is using those techniques on amphibians.
So that was Jeff Stryker from our show Herptiles from the Natural History Museum, obviously revealing that the Natural History Museum does a lot more research than we imagine. Getting science out into the public was really the subject of our show, where we were joined by our guest Simon Singh. What he was talking about was the Simpsons. Yeah, the yellow family we know and love. And not only that, but specifically all about the mathematics that is smuggled into the Simpsons. I didn't realize there was quite so much. And here is Matilda quizzing Simon about exactly how that happened.
It's in the Simpsons.
Gosh, my favorite bit, I suppose my favorite bit is the one where I actually noticed that there was maths in The Simpsons, because I'd been watching it for years and I hadn't even noticed it. But there's an episode called The Wizard of Evergreen Terrace. Now, the Wizard of Menlo Park was Thomas Edison, the great inventor. And the Wizard of Evergreen Terrace is when Homer wants to become a great inventor like Edison. And so he's in his basement building all sorts of weird gadgets, weird pointless gadgets, and he's scribbling stuff on a blackboard, as you might do if you're an inventor. And it's just full of maths. Again, you only see it for a second. You have to pause it to really understand what it is. But there's one line that's all about topology. There's one line about the density of the universe. There's one line where he predicts the mass of the Higgs boson. 12 years before it's discovered, he gets the mass pretty accurate. And then there's another line all about Fermat's last theorem. And my first book was all about Fermat's last theorem. And so to see that, it's quite... the most notorious problem in the history of maths appearing in The Simpsons alerted me to something interesting going on. And I'm a particle physicist by training, so I noticed the Higgs mass formula. I rang up one of the writers, or I emailed him, David X. Cohen, and I said, your name is on the credits of this show. What's going on? And he did a degree in physics, like me, and then he... did a master's in computer science, and he'd actually written research papers in mathematics. And he explained that there were loads of mathematicians writing on The Simpsons, people, not just people with degrees in maths, although, they're pretty special, but people with master's degrees or PhDs. One guy was even a professor at Yale and gave it all up to become a Simpsons writer.
Wow.
And then they're not mathematicians now, they're comedy writers on the world's most successful comedy. But they still love maths, and the way they express that love of maths is by hiding mathematical references in the show. And they've been doing it for 25 years.
And what do you think is the link? What draws mathematicians to comedy?
There's a lot of them around. Just in the UK, people like Dara Brian did physics at maths at University College Dublin, I think. Dave Gorman was doing a degree in maths before he quit to become a BAFTA award-winning writer and then performer. Ramesh Raghunathan was a math teacher. Paul Foote, there are loads of them. And I have a chapter in the book where I interviewed all the writers. And I said, why do you think, you've all been drawn to comedy? And there are various explanations. One of them was that math is about logic and playing with logic and stretching logic and bending logic. And if you break logic and you get to the illogical, that often leads to humour. One of them said it's partly about intellectual stamina. If you're doing a math problem, you've got to think about it really hard for a long time. And writing comedy, you have to think really hard for a long time. One of them said it was like a group activity. You know, we all sit down around a table and we discuss ideas and maths.
People if it's might a common interest, then it becomes kind of like
but also people...
That was Simon Singh there talking about the science of the Simpsons. And one of the Simpsons, or one of Simon's mathematical choices, that was Simon Singh there with the science of the Simpsons. And one of Simon's mathematical choices was Nena with 99 Luftballons. So here it is. Luftballons by Nena. The best thing about this show is learning such different things, and as well as listening to the experts in their field tell us about all the wonderful things they know, they can sometimes show us exactly what they're talking about. One of the best guests for this was Thomas Prophet, and Thomas came in. He's a researcher from Oxford University, and he's looking at how early humans and primates used tools in the past, and even with some apes and primates, how they use tools today. He brought in some bits of flint into the studio, and we actually managed to make our own tools. So here's a bit of us just messing around in the studio and ending up with some of the first ever human tools that we made.
Flint napping, right, so we're going to have a go at it ourselves.
A bit of a demonstration.
What we've got here is we've got a couple of rather large pieces of flint. They're probably about the size of your fist or slightly bigger.
Yep.
And then you've also got these kind of rounded pebble-like.
These are quartzite river cobbles, basically. They're just a hard, rounded cobble that you would find in any large river, basically.
Okay, so and that's just been like nice and smooth by the flow of the water.
Yeah, and you need this nice round, smooth surface, or at least a rounded surface, so that when you direct the force into the flint, it's only directed at one specific point. If you had a really kind of undulating and awkward shaped stone, the force would be directed at several points, and you wouldn't really get any outcomes at all.
Brilliant. So, take it away. Let's have a go.
I'm not sure how good this is going to sound on.
No.
On the radio.
This is great. So Tom's just kind of turning over. He seems to be picking.
Basically, what you're looking for all the time is that there's an angle of less than 90 degrees. If you strike the flint core, the large block of flint, at an angle of greater than 90 degrees, nothing happens. The conchoidal fracture, the mechanism for making these flakes, can't start. Basically, so right. It has to be less than 90 degrees. And so what you're looking for is this angle, and I've, knowing that I was going to bring these on, I found pieces that actually have these angles on them already. So hopefully, there's always a bit of error potentially in this, but you know we'll see what we can do.
And you've got some bits of material here as well. Is that you're going to use now, or
the material on the floor?
These little square pieces, are these?
Oh no, those are basically that. Because you can flint nap either just by holding it on your hand, or you can flint nap by putting it on your leg.
Okay.
When you put it on your leg, because these things are really sharp, they slice through your clothes, and then they slice through your leg. And
that's
really
less
painful.
Than ideal.
No. So those are just leather.
Not
leather
what we
pieces.
Want with the Soho Radio Health and Safety.
No, not at all. And it ruins the floor.
The blood everywhere.
But yeah, so okay, we'll give it a go. We'll see what happens.
Okay, right. So I'm just like finding a sharp edge and then trying to kind of hit that sharp edge in such a way that go on, give it a crack. Oh, there you go. Oh, wow.
There
and
we
so
go.
Actually what's come off is kind of a flake that's probably about a centimetre thick.
Yeah, it's quite a thick flake, but it has a sharp edge on it, and that's all you need. That is the earliest technology known to man, and that is all you need. You could quite easily butcher an entire elephant just with that single
flake.
Yeah,
it literally looks like a kind of spearhead already.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the edges on these things go down to less than an atom thick, so... They are incredibly, incredibly sharp.
So if you look at them with a microscope. They are atomically sharp.
Absolutely.
That is amazing.
Yeah, so there are some surgeons in the States that will occasionally use obsidian blades, so made in this exact same way, for operating on the eye.
That is amazing.
Because they're if you look at them under the microscope and you compare them to a surgical scalpel, they are considerably smoother.
Wow, that's. I mean, people even struggle now to make things that are atomically sharp.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
And they're brilliant. They don't, you know, they very rarely need to be sharpening. And if you you know, that's a single flake, it took less than a
like
second to
hits.
Make. And you can get hundreds from a single piece of flint, so they're incredibly useful.
So that was Thomas Prophet talking about the ancient tools that he made for us in the studio. I actually managed to help him, and well, I didn't do quite as well as him, but I came away with my own flakes. That was another fascinating person we had on. We don't always just have people choosing the music, and we've had people coming on and doing their own songs, actually. And Kyle Evans is a maths teacher and a mathematically minded stand-up comic. And when he came to the studio, we spent some time talking about some of his favorite bits of maths. And he also ended up giving us a rendition of one of his very own songs. So here's Kyle now. Did you choose this one?
Yeah, well, I do this, I do an hour long comedy, maths, music, folk show. I basically have created a show that only one person in the world would want to go to.
Niche.
And they're on the stage at the time, yeah. But part of it is where I look at mathematically incorrect pop songs. For example, there's a song by Common called Making a Name for Ourselves, where the first line goes, I'm your worst nightmare squared. That's double for anyone who ain't mathematically aware, which I think is fantastic. I don't know if it's ironic or not. But because of this, people kind of give me suggestions, and a friend sent me this article in the NME, like scientifically incorrect pop songs. But they were really rubbish suggestions that anyone could come up with. And they kind of slammed Beyonce for this song, because she says, I don't know much about algebra, but I know 1 plus 1 equals 2. And they say, actually, Beyonce, that's just basic arithmetic. But I suppose not many things rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem. Which I sort of take issue with on two fronts. Because Beyonce knows that that's not algebra. Because it's what she says in the song. I don't know much about algebra, but I know 1 plus 1 equals 2. So she's perfectly willing to accept that. But also, I disagree with the NME because there are lots of things that rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem. Which I'm going to attempt to show you now. Is that okay?
No, yeah, please
right,
do.
Right, let's do that. The enemy says that not many things rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem. Well, I've constructed a list and just thought you might like to hear them. You're all intelligent people, so you have no need to fear them. The enemy says that not many things rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem. When I'm done and finished, that's when you can shout and cheer 'em. You're gonna say you love it, and you won't need a truth serum. The currency in Morocco and the United Emirates is the dirham. And the enemy says that not many things rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem. And just cause I've got a tiny guitar, that don't make me Ed Sheeran. I've met a lot of musicians, but I've still never got near him. He released an album called Multiply and still sold like 10 million. That was a bit of a stretch. But the enemy's wrong, cause plenty of things rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem. Oh, the enemy's wrong, cause plenty of things rhyme with Pythagoras' theorem.
Woo!
Thank you.
Oh, that's great. That was so good.
That was Kyle Evans with his brilliant ditty on Pythagoras' theorem. And you'd think that in a science and music show, this song would have come up before. And there's a song that I've always wanted to play on the show, but unfortunately, no one's ever chosen it. So now, in this review on our 100th episode, is my chance to really get it out there. And this is by Tom Lehrer, who's a brilliant comedy singer. And this song is dedicated to and containing all of the elements.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium.
Brilliant. That was Tom Lehrer with his song The Elements.
Science News.
Just me this week for Science News. So one thing I want to tell you a little bit about is the dusty space clouds that have just been discovered. So these are the Kordulewski dust clouds, and they're kind of like satellites that are between the Earth and the Moon, or nearby. But they're just made of collections of dust, and it's quite amazing because these dust clouds were actually first seen back in 1961 when a Polish astronomer saw them and he reported them. And people have tried to look for them ever since and they haven't really managed it. And the reason these dust clouds can accumulate and actually stay there is because of this thing called Lagrangian points. And Lagrangian points are almost, they're like parking spaces in space. And because the Earth-Moon system is spinning around, there are certain points where the Earth's gravity and the Moon's gravity cancel out of the fact that the whole thing's spinning around. So with respect to the Earth and the Moon, they just stay in the same place. And so these were discovered a little while ago from astronomers at Vörös-Lőrend University in Budapest. They were looking for the clouds using specially designed filters to detect polarized light at the private observatory there. And the team finally spotted this telltale shimmer at L5, which stands for Lagrangian 0.5. And apparently computer simulations then suggested that these points, these L4 and L5 points, they're like the numbered Lagrangian points, may hang around only for years or decades, but the sun's gravity eventually drags them out and scatters them into space, and then it takes a while for them to accumulate again. So that might explain this kind of like result where they were seen in the 60s and then not seen again. So I kind of think amazing that even now there are things that had been discovered, fell out of knowledge, and then were discovered again. The next thing I've got is something that's really cool, which is about these air batteries. So these are metal air batteries. And so the idea is that you take a metal, and that acts as one of the sides of the battery, and then you have an electrolyte, which contains elements, but it takes in the oxygen from the air, and then the oxygen acts as the charge carrier, essentially, in the battery. And so you can generate batteries from just these bits of aluminium and electrolyte material. Now, the problem with these batteries is that they tend to corrode. You put anything in water, you know, in something as reactive as aluminium, it tends to corrode. And so it means that these batteries can only have a shelf life of something about a month. But so a team at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. managed to get around this by putting a thin film of oil in between the aluminium and the electrolyte when it's not being used. So the idea is that when you turn the battery off, the oil flows into the gap between the two, separated by a membrane, and then when you turn it back on again, the oil's drained out and the battery can start working. And so this may be a new battery that has a much higher energy density, and that's kind of the thing that we're really interested in, is getting loads of energy out of just a tiny little battery. This is something that might actually be able to do that. So they could be used for, you know, off-grid energy supplies, drones and cars, everything even could do with these new batteries. And the last thing that I have for you was a discovery on the island of Borneo that cave art emerged both in Southeast Asia and in Europe at around the same time, which is kind of amazing. Some of the oldest paintings we know are in Spain, but these ones discovered on the island of Borneo date to at least 40,000 years ago, reported a team from Griffith University in Australia. And they have pictures of creatures, there are pictures of hand outlines, and some of these hand outlines could be as old as 51,000 years old. And I just think it's kind of amazing that there are these expressions of artwork that arrive all over the world at around about the same time. To think that we were at any point not interconnected is probably wrong. So appropriately, we're going to have Mumford & Sons with The Cave.
It's empty in the valley of your heart. The sun, it rises slowly as you walk
away from all the fears and all the faults you've left behind. The harvest left no food for you to eat. You cannibal, you meat eater, you see. But I've seen the same, I know the shame in your defeat.
Next, I'm going to play an extract of an interview with Richard Feynman. Feynman was a physicist who managed to reformulate quantum mechanics into a novel form during his PhD, which is a formidable feat, an achievement that's the envy of anyone who's managed to get to the end of such a qualification. Feynman was a brilliant physicist and even more brilliant teacher. He ended up working at Los Alamos on the first nuclear bomb and cracked safes there as a bit of a joke. But the clip that I've chosen is more to do with his teaching, and I feel like this is because it's so obvious to me how when asked a question, which appears to be a simple question, he somehow manages to understand the question better than the person asking it. So this is from a BBC archive recording of an interview on Fun to Imagine in 1983.
If you get hold of two magnets and you push them, you can feel this pushing between them. Turn it around the other way and they slam together. Now, what is it, the feeling between those two magnets?
What do you mean, what's the feeling between the two magnets?
There's something there, isn't there? I mean, the sensation is that there's something there when you push these two magnets together.
Listen to my question. What is the meaning when you say that there's a feeling? Of course you feel it. Now, what do you want to know?
What I want to know is what's going on between these two bits of metal.
The magnets repel each other.
What does that mean, or why are they doing that, or how are they doing it?
I must say,
I think that's a perfectly reasonable question.
Of course it's a reason. It's an excellent question. Okay. But the problem that you're asking, you see, when you ask why something happens, how does a person answer why something happens? For example, Aunt Minnie is in a hospital. Why? Because she slipped. She went out and she slipped on the ice and broke her hip. That satisfies people. It satisfies, but it wouldn't satisfy someone who came from another planet, knew nothing about things. First, you understand why. When you break your hip, do you go to the hospital? How do you get to the hospital when the hip is broken? Well, because her husband, seeing that she had the hip was broken, called the hospital up and sent somebody to get her. All that is understood by people. Now, when you explain a why, you have to be in some framework that you allow something to be true. Otherwise, you're perpetually asking why. Why did the husband call up the hospital? Because husband is interested in his wife's welfare. Not always. Some husbands aren't interested in their wife's welfare when they're drunk and they're angry. And so you begin to get a very interesting understanding of the world and all its complications. In order to if you try to follow anything up, you go deeper and deeper in various directions. For example, you could go, well, why did she slip on the ice? Well, ice is slippery. Everybody knows that. No problem. But you ask, why is ice slippery? That's kind of curious. Ice is extremely slippery. It's very interesting. You say, how does it work? You could either say, I'm satisfied that you've answered me. Ice is slippery. That explains it. Or you could go on and say, why is ice slippery? And then you're involved with something, because there aren't many things as slippery as ice. It's very hard to get greasy stuff, but that's sort of wet and slimy. But a solid that's so slippery? Because it is in the case of ice that when you stand on it, they say, momentarily the pressure melts the ice a little bit, so you got a sort of instantaneous water surface on which you're slipping. Why on ice and not on other things? Because ice expands when it, water expands when it freezes, so the pressure tries to undo the expansion and melts it. Is capable of melting it, but other substances contract when they're freezing, and when you push them, they're just as satisfied to be solid. Why does water expand when it freezes, and other substances don't expand when they freeze? All right, I'm not answering your question, but I'm telling you how difficult a why question is. You have to know what it is that you're permitted to understand and allow to be understood and known, and what it is you're not. You'll notice in this example that the more I ask why, it gets interesting after all. That's my idea, that the deeper a thing is, the more interesting it is. And We could even go further and say, why did she fall down when she slipped? That has to do with gravity. It involves in all the planets and everything else. Never mind. It goes on and on. Now, when you ask, for example, why two magnets repel, there are many different levels. It depends on whether you're a student of physics or an ordinary person who doesn't know anything or not. If you're somebody who doesn't know anything at all about it, all I can say is that there's a magnetic force that makes them repel and that you're feeling that force. And you say, but that's very strange because I don't feel kind of force like that in other circumstances. When you turn them the other way, they attract. There's a very analogous force, electrical force, which is the same kind of a question. And you say, that's also very weird. But you're not at all disturbed by the fact that when you put your hand on the chair, it pushes you back. But we found out by looking at it that that's the same force, as a matter of fact, the electrical force, not magnetic exactly in that case, but it's the same electrical repulsions that are involved in keeping your finger away from the chair, because everything's made out of its electrical forces in minor and microscopic details. There's other forces involved, but this is connected to electrical forces. It turns out that the magnetic and the electric force with which I wish to explain these things, this repulsion in the first place, is what ultimately is the deeper thing that we have to start, that we can start with, to explain many other things that looked like they were, everybody would just accept them. You know, you can't put your hand through the chair. That's taken for granted. But that you can't put your hand through the chair, when looked at more closely, why, that involves these same repulsive forces that appear in magnets. The situation you then have to explain is why in magnets it goes over a bigger distance than it ordinarily. And there it has to do with the fact that in iron, all the electrons are spinning in the same direction. They all get lined up, and they magnify the effect of the force until it's large enough at a distance that you can feel it. But it's a force which is present all the time and very common, and is in a basic force of almost, I mean, I can go a little further back if I were more technical, but at an early level, I just have to tell you that's going to be one of the things you'll just have to take as an element in the world, the existence of magnetic repulsion or electrical attraction, magnetic attraction. I can't explain that attraction in terms of anything else that's familiar to you. For example, if we say the magnets attract like as if they were connected by rubber bands, I would be cheating you, because they're not connected by rubber bands. I shouldn't be in trouble. You'd soon ask me about the nature of the band. And secondly, if you were curious enough, you'd ask me why rubber bands tend to pull back together again, and I would end up explaining that in terms of electrical forces, which are the very things that I'm trying to use the rubber bands to explain, so I have cheated very badly, you see. So I'm not going to be able to give you an answer to why magnets attract each other, except to tell you that they do.
That was an extract from the historical special we did a little while back, where we went back in history to try and hear a little bit from some of the scientists of the past, some of which we have no recordings of, so we enlisted some of the help of some actors to recreate those. It's really true that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and some of these guys I would have loved to have had on the podcast and radio show for real. But we don't know everything. That's the other thing the show has certainly taught me, is that there's so much we don't know. And not only that, there are so many scientists battling out on the edge of human knowledge, each of them learning a little bit more than the people that came before them. And it's our tiny contribution here on Science Mixtape to try and bring you the voices of these tireless scientists who try to learn just a little bit more in the process. So here, lastly, to remind you of the vastness of what we don't know, is Roberto Trotta from our episode Dark, Darker, Darkest. But firstly, Roberto, your work focuses on dark matter and dark energy. For those people who aren't familiar with these concepts, what are they?
Which is pretty much everybody, because we, the scientists who are trying to figure out, are also very much unfamiliar with them, despite the fact that we've been studying this stuff for 100 years. And in fact, one of the most astonishing discoveries of modern cosmology, the study of the universe, is that everything that we see in the sky, be it with the naked eye or with our most powerful telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope, everything that's out there that we can see is actually a tiny little fraction of everything there is. In fact, only about 5% of the universe, as we know it, shines, emits light in any kind of form. And that leaves 95% of the universe, almost the totality of the universe, completely dark, completely mysterious, and as of yet, unknown, undiscovered. And so dark energy, dark matter, together, they make up 95% of the universe. We don't know exactly what they are, but clearly they are so important to the fundamental nature of the universe that we must find out. So really, our quest is to find out what is the dark matter of the universe that keeps the universe together, what is the dark energy of the universe that's trying to make it actually break apart in some sense. And it's an astonishing fact that we still don't know pretty much anything about either of them.
So, and they're two kind of... So that's Roberto Trotta there telling us how we don't really know anything about anything, which I think is true. That's it for us on Science Mixtape. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so you can find us on @ScienceMixtape, be it Twitter, Instagram, MySpace. I'm kidding, we don't have a MySpace page. Maybe we should make one. Anyway, that's all from us. We are going to finish up with Frank Wilson and Do I Love You. Thank you and goodbye.